Florida prisons and their COVID problem. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There's a new report out by the Orlando Sentinel that shows a disturbing trend. Florida prisons are not doing enough to protect staff and prisoners from COVID. Today we'll learn about those trends and hear some powerful stories. Also, Haiti has a new prime minister, but gangs rule much of the country. What has to happen for the island nation to hold free and safe elections? And finally,
there's so many stories that deserve a rich, highly produced, really thoughtful way of understanding the world.
WLRN will soon carry one of the most popular podcasts in the country. We spoke with host Michael Barbaro of the New York Times about The Daily. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the death rate for those with COVID at Florida correctional facilities is more than 1.5 times that of the general public in the state. A new report from the Orlando Sentinel compiled a comprehensive list of the men and women who died of the virus while serving a felony sentence, including details about their last days. Grace Tuohy worked on that report, and she's on the newspaper's Justice and Safety team, and she joins us now. And also joining us is Catherine Nowotny. She's an associate professor at the University of Miami's Department of Sociology and the co-founder of the COVID Prison Project, which tracks the virus nationwide at incarceration facilities. I appreciate having both of you with me. Grace, I want to start with you. In your reporting, you were able to talk with families who lost loved ones to COVID who were in the prison system. What stories really stood out to you?
Yeah, we were able to speak to a lot of families. I mean, overall, the stories were heartbreaking and really difficult to hear. But you know, one story that stood out was we spoke with Donnie White's sister. Donnie White was 66 years old and serving a 15-year sentence for a nonviolent crime, a drug offense. And, you know, his sister said he was relatively healthy. He had diabetes, but she said it was well managed. But within 4 days when she had last heard from him, she ended up finding out that he had actually died in a hospital. So the really sad thing about his death is that his family never got a call that he was sick with COVID, that he was in a hospital, and never even got a call that he had died. She started calling the prison because she was concerned. She hadn't heard from him. And that's definitely something that we heard from a lot of families. They were just left in the dark. Prison officials weren't giving them phone calls, weren't giving them updates. And we know how scary COVID is out on the outside. And it's just a completely different experience for people who are on the inside. You know, we also heard from other families. I spoke with the foster mother of Adela Ramirez. She was only 32 years old. She was the youngest person to die in Florida prisons of COVID. But, you know, she said that her daughter had been sick for days and hadn't been tested, hadn't been isolated, hadn't been quarantined. And she thinks if, you know, they had responded quicker and had better precautions and care, that her daughter would have lived and should have lived. So we heard that across the board as well, and have been hearing that for more than the last year and a half, for sure, that there wasn't a quick enough response and there wasn't a comprehensive enough response to this disease.
And that was, you know, one of the things too about these stories that you collected that they all have in common is just lack of information to the families. Catherine, unfortunately, these stories are not uncommon. You co-founded the COVID Prison Project to collect data on the state of COVID-19 in correctional facilities within the country. How did the idea for that project come about?
Yeah, so my research really focuses on trying to improve the health and well-being of people who are impacted by the criminal justice system. And so some colleagues of mine from across the country, you know, in March of last year, at the beginning of the pandemic, we knew COVID-19 pandemic was going to be just devastating in prisons and jails. You know, we've known for decades, right, that prisons and jails are incubators of infectious disease due to, you know, close living quarters, due to not having like full access to sanitary supplies, right, like being able to wash your hands frequently or having alcohol-based hand sanitizer. and so forth. And so we wanted to really track and get a comprehensive national view of what was the course of COVID-19 within prisons in the United States. And that's, you know, we have 50 state prison systems, we have the Federal Bureau of Prisons, we have ICE. And so we wanted to get a big picture idea of what's happening with COVID-19, how does the death and case rates in prisons compare to the general state populations, what policies are Departments of Corrections implementing and when are they implementing them, and to really try to provide comprehensive information for the public, for policymakers, and also to be able to push for, you know, greater or advocate for greater transparency in the way that Departments of Corrections were reporting their data. I mean, as Grace and you mentioned, right, you know, families were desperate for information, you know, on their loved ones who were incarcerated. And so we tried, you know, to present things to the public in a way that was easy to digest, so people could really understand what was happening.
And Catherine, by the way, getting all that information, how difficult or maybe easy was it to get it?
So it was really difficult in that, as I mentioned, there's so many different systems, and every system was reporting information in different ways. So they had different definitions of, you know, isolation. They had different definitions of what is a recovered case. They had different ways of reporting testing and cases. And so we had a team of dozens of volunteers and students working with us to try to, you know, decide how can we best merge this information together? How can we make sure that the case count in Florida is comparable to the case count in, say, Texas? And so it was, it took many, many, many people hours. We were doing manual scraping of data. You know, eventually we got partnered with some people with computer skills who could do web scraping for us. But it was really difficult to be able to reconcile across states because there was just no standardization.
It's impressive, the information that's been gathered. Grace, you know, we have vaccines now. I'm wondering from your reporting, what did you find out about the accessibility of these vaccines? Are staff and prisoners getting vaccinated?
That's a great question. It definitely took a while for vaccines to get into Florida's prisons for people who are incarcerated. We still don't have any real numbers about staff in Florida's prisons. The state has not made that data available, and it's unclear they're even asking staff, you know, if they're vaccinated. What we do know is that vaccines are available to people who are incarcerated now. They have been since April is when they got into the prisons. And according to the Department of Corrections, about 33,000 people who are incarcerated have gotten at least one dose of a vaccine, which is about 40% of the state prison population right now.
Is there an effort to raise that vaccination rate, though?
You know, we're not aware of any, you know, massive effort at this point. You know, the Department of Corrections has said that they're putting out information, and if someone, you know, comes forward and changes their mind and wants it, they will make the vaccine available. But we haven't heard of any, you know, across the board, really big push or effort. So there's a lot of people that are unvaccinated, and we know that people are, you know, positive right now inside of Florida prisons, but we don't know a lot about it.
And Catherine, I mean, you know, again, looking across the country, can we say there are states that are pushing to make sure that their staff and prison populations are getting vaccinated? Can we compare Florida to anybody else?
Sure, yes, definitely. So Florida, as Grace mentioned, was one of the last states to start allocating vaccines to its inmate population. And that really had to do with, you know, the governor and the state. Florida was one of the few states who did not have a vaccine allocation plan in place for their prison system, whereas the majority, 30 other states, did. And many states prioritized incarcerated people in phase one for vaccine allocation. And so Florida was definitely slow relative to the majority of US states. And other states are also offering vaccines for their staff, so they're able to keep track of it. And that's also something that Florida's not doing, which is, you know, why we don't know what this vaccination looks like among staff in Florida prisons.
And I mean, that leads to the question of the CDC now reversing their guidance on masks, saying that even if you are vaccinated, you should be wearing them inside. Do we know if Florida prisons have changed that, you know, their thoughts on that and trying to get more people to mask up?
Yeah, so we have not heard anything about them reversing course on masks. And I mean, I will say that the CDC puts out specific guidelines for correctional facilities, and the CDC guidelines still recommend masking in correctional facilities. So even though that's changed for the general public, you know, they still have special guidelines for corrections. And so, you know, I hope that they'll, you know, continue to have these preventative measures, but we haven't heard anything about that. So we just don't know.
I'm talking with Catherine Nowotny. She's an associate professor at the University of Miami's Department of Sociology. She's also the co-founder of the COVID Prison Project, which tracks the virus nationwide in incarceration facilities. We're also talking with Grace Tuohy, reporter for the Orlando Sentinel, part of the Justice and Safety team. She recently published a special report about how COVID spread in Florida prisons, killing hundreds. And you can find that report and more information on this on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Grace, in your reporting, you found that more than 30% of the people who died in prison of COVID-19 were eligible for parole at the time of their death. So these are people who they could have been released at least temporarily.
Yeah, so Florida has kind of a weird parole system. And so what parole means is, you know, it's usually people who've served long sentences and they're eligible for a supervised release. So they would still be under, you know, state watch in some capacity. And so the people who are eligible for parole in Florida all have served decades in prison at this point, also for very serious crimes, so usually murder or rape. But the parole was effectively eliminated by the state in 1995. And so, you know, that's why these people have served so long. So they are mostly older. But yeah, they could have been released. They were eligible for parole. They have parole hearings every once in a while. And the Florida Commission on Offender Review, it's a, you know, a small government body that makes these decisions, had not released them for whatever reason. And so a lot of them have been parole eligible for years, if not decades at this point, and, you know, were never released.
Catherine, Grace had reported that the Florida Department of Corrections Secretary Mark Inch had said that he's proud of his agency's response to the pandemic. He added that Florida's prison death numbers are not out of line with other large state correction systems. But you kind of touched on this a little a moment ago. I mean, and I'm just wondering, again, how Florida compared to some of those larger states, to the rest of the country, when it came to its control of COVID-19. Is it something that we could say we did a good job?
So I think every Department of Corrections, you know, could have done a better job. And unfortunately, you know, Secretary Inch is not incorrect. All large prison systems saw higher mortality rates from COVID-19 within their system than they did in the general population. So this is a phenomenon that has really hit all state prison systems that are experiencing higher numbers of death. I think one of the things, you know, it's hard to assess, you know, in terms of how well Florida did without knowing additional information in terms of, you know, who is it that's dying? You know, what is their age at death? Were there racial equity and who was dying? What about hospitalization rates? And this is information we just don't have from Florida or hardly any systems at all.
And I also need to, you know, correct something I just said. It's not how they've done, it's how they're doing, because we're still in a pandemic. Mm-hmm. Grace, you know, since your report was published, have you heard from any state officials, prison officials? You know, do they have anything to say about what you've pointed out?
You know, we really have not heard from them much. You know, they continue to say that protecting the health and safety of their prison population and staff is their highest priority, but we really have gotten no answers or no response on, you know, what they would change or make better. You know, people who we've heard from are families or advocates of people who are incarcerated or even, you know, people who used to work at the prison system and are also concerned about what's happening inside. And, you know, COVID obviously, as we know, is bad everywhere, but in prisons, it really just kind of highlighted a lot of the other issues that are going on inside state prisons. You know, like Catherine pointed out, you know, it's hard to socially distance. You know, there's a lot of elderly people in Florida's prison population. There's a lot of times poor medical care. So, you know, it kind of highlighted all these issues that were already there, and COVID made it a lot worse, it seems like.
Catherine, are you having any conversations with any other organizations, activists, or groups, any officials, you know, to try to improve, you know, safety in these facilities? Again, even if it's basic things like masks and hand sanitizer, et cetera.
Yeah, so we've done a couple of things. So we've had conversations with federal policymakers, you know, to think about what could the federal government, potentially mandate, you know, for the pandemic or in the future, particularly for the Federal Bureau of Prisons and then for state prison systems. We've also been working providing data for local activist groups or local groups that are concerned about the conditions of confinement. And so we get requests for data that we're able to provide for them, and then they're able to use it, you know, to advocate for, you know, greater compassionate release or earlier parole or other reentry measures, you know, within their county or within their state.
It's a powerful report, very interesting information. And again, a reminder that we're still in this pandemic, so a lot of people still struggling and suffering. I want to thank my guest, Catherine Nowotny, Associate Professor at the University of Miami, co-founder of the COVID Prison Project, and Grace Tuohy, reporter for the Orlando Sentinel's Justice and Safety Team. Learn more about that report, by the way, just go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. Grace, Catherine, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, we're going to get the latest on the assassination of Haiti's president and plans to hold elections this year. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. A number of federal law enforcement officers were in South Florida earlier this week, serving the first search warrants in the investigation into the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. The focus of the investigation has been on a private security company in Doral, which reportedly contracted ex-Colombian military officers to conduct the assassination. Meanwhile, the new Haitian Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, addressed the nation yesterday in his first public address, vowing to make democratic elections happen quickly and smoothly. We're joined now by WLRN's Latin America correspondent, Tim Padgett. Tim, in the search warrants that were served earlier this week, who are federal law enforcement in South Florida focusing on at this point?
Well, mainly two figures, one a Venezuelan expat, one an Ecuadorian expat. The Venezuelan expat's name is Antonio Intriago. He owns, as you pointed out, a private security firm in Doral known as CTU. And that firm, according to Haitian police, was hired by the people who were concocting this mission that turned into an assassination. He was hired to recruit more than 20 Colombian mercenaries, ex-Colombian military soldiers, to take part in this mission to install this Haitian American here named Christian Emmanuel Sanon, to install him as the new president in Haiti. Again, this all sounds very delusional, but these are the facts. To install him. And again, as I said, this whole mission somehow degenerated into a brutal assassination of President Moïse. The other person they're looking at, as I said, is the Ecuadorian expat named Walter Ventimiglia, who owns a loan brokerage company in Broward County. And they were serving search warrants at his home and offices there as well, because he apparently loaned money to this effort of Sanon's, and therefore they're trying to retrace where that money went in an effort to better understand just how this whole bizarre thing came together.
All right, so these security groups, they have lawyers, and I'm wondering what those lawyers have said about the search warrants.
Well, we don't have not been hearing from any lawyers for Antonio Intriago, the owner of the security firm, because we don't know his whereabouts. No one's really, neither him nor anyone else really seems to be speaking for, on his behalf. Now, Walter Ventimiglia's lawyer, Walter Ventimiglia being, again, the loan broker who is suspected by the Haitian police of having helped finance this mission, his lawyer has said that Ventimiglia only thought that he was helping to finance a Haitian charity project, a project to help Haitian businesses and charities and infrastructure. He had no idea that any of this money would be going for the kind of thing that actually happened on July 7th in Port-au-Prince.
All right. So meanwhile, you have the new prime minister, Ariel Henry. He spoke to the public yesterday in his first major televised press conference. What was the focus of his speech?
Well, first of all, he wanted to assure everybody that his new government, as we may need to explain to people, in Haiti, the president is the head of state, but the prime minister is the person who actually runs the government. And so according to the Haitian constitution, the prime minister heads up a council of ministers to sort of take the place of the president when the president is assassinated. So Ariel Henry is the de facto leader right now of Haiti, and he has promised that his interim government here will get to the bottom of who was behind this whole effort that ended up, as I said, killing President Moïse. One of the big questions that he now has to that he and his team have to answer, because this investigation seems to have run into a little bit of a brick wall at this point. The big question now is who inside Haiti was helping these forces from outside of Haiti come in and commit this act that they did. There are a lot of fingers being pointed all over the place, but that is the big question right now. And that's one of the big things that his interim government is going to have to follow through with.
As you said, this is a very strange story, but those are the facts. Again, talking with WLRN's Latin America correspondent, Tim Padgett. Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
And again, federal agents served a search warrant earlier this week in South Florida as part of their investigation into the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. You can find more of our reporting on the political crisis in Haiti. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. I want to turn over now to Nixon Bomba. He goes by Bomba. He's part of the American Jewish World Service in Haiti, working on social justice issues and workers' rights. Bomba, thank you so much for the time. I wanted to start by asking you that much of your focus has been on ensuring Haitians have the right to a fair democratic process. Why does that remain such a challenge in the country?
Thank you so much for inviting me to share my understanding of what's happened in my country and my life in Port-au-Prince City. And as you said in your introduction, I'm Bomba. I spent all my life over the last 20 years as activist in social movement and social justice movement in Haiti. And we have this commitment to work to very deep social change in the country, to restore faith and the institution, and trying to make Haitian life matter for other international actors and the elites in the country. And since the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, we are living in very confusing time. Confusing time because, you know, as you can imagine, Haiti is one of hard country to have access to information. In terms of this crime, where nobody can say what was the magical reset those people had to get into the home of the former president and to kill him in the way they did that. But now we are now in a situation marked by confusion in terms on the investigation on Jovenel Moïse's death, confusion also who led the country right now.
And
we are living a very strange time because it is the first time since the earthquake at the infrastructural level, we don't have state symbol.
Yeah.
Like no parliament. No palace, national palace, no judiciary palace.
Let me ask you this, now, though, Bomba, if I may. You know, you talk about these confusing times. And
yes.
I wanted your thoughts on your current prime minister, Henri. And I wanted you to just tell me what you think about his role moving forward, trying to hold those elections, and what you think his role should be and what role foreign governments should take in this.
Yep. Yeah, I have 2 points to add to this question that you addressed to me. First, obviously, it is not our prime minister because we don't have any role. We didn't play any role in choosing Ariel Henry as prime minister. He was It was nominated de facto by Jovenel Moïse. As you know, there is no parliament to validate his power, to approve his nomination. It was pushed by international communities. It's like international community prime ministers, minister, and PhD cap prime minister. We don't know anything about the agenda of this prime minister, but we heard he said he will continue with the vast majority of what Jovenel Moïse committed to do, like election, referendum, fighting against security. And then what as Haitian people, we know, we can acknowledge we need someone in place to manage current things in the country, but we are advocating, we are requesting for a clear process, a participatory process, an inclusive process to have a consensus to move forward with a transitional government.
And Bomba, the other thing too is this, the challenge right now, because he wants, you know, the prime minister has said that he wants these elections this year. But one of the challenges is you have a lot of powerful gangs in control of many areas. What's the responsibility of that government, and do you think international help needs to come in?
Yeah, you know, we are living in Haiti. It's at the death of Jovenel Moïse is a clear sign of the situation of terror we are living in the country. Over the last 2 years, we are living in a state of terror. We are having a state of war organized by the government toward the gang they put in place to maintain the power. It was like electoral strategies to control whole very populated area around Port-au-Prince and Sloom area where very poor people living, and to control the next election. This gang is part of the strategy of this government who nominated Ariel Henry as the prime minister. Ariel Henry is part of the problem, not of the solution. He can manage some things briefly for the next couple of weeks or months, but we need to have a clear transition. We can work to this uncertainty and security situation we are living in the country in terms of investigate, combating impunity for the gangs who committed a lot of crimes in the country, but also open the gate for other young people who are part of this structural and historical victims of this system, and to have a better opportunity to gain their life differently.
Let me ask you this, Bomba, and brief answer because of time. Again, do you think you can have a fair and safe election this year?
No, just before the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, no Haitian believe that we can have election at that time, because we can organize election in a country where 60% of the territory is controlled by gang. Or we can organize election in a country where the political leader, they can't campaign to run for presidents or the position in the government. There's no way to organize election this year.
Yeah.
And we call the international communities and other actors to know, to hear this voice. We need time, process, mechanism to restore democratic order, to rebuild the faith into the institution in the country, and then to combat the insecurity and combating impunity, but also in providing opportunity to the young people to have other alternatives to life, other options.
I have to jump in there. There's a lot to unwrap in this. Nixon Bomba, again, from the American Jewish World Service in Haiti, again, working on social justice issues and workers' rights. Bomba, I really do appreciate it. There's so much more to talk about on this story, but we're not done. We'll definitely be covering more of this story in the months to come. Thank you so much for the time. We're going to move right along here because of time. I apologize about that. But still to come, we're going to hear from the host of one of the most popular podcasts in the country, which is coming to WLRN.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily.
Actually, welcome back to Sundial on WLRN, and I'm Luis Hernandez. For the past 4 years, the New York Times has released a daily podcast examining critical stories from its reporters around the globe. They're normally 20 to 25 minutes in length, featuring a one-on-one conversation with host Michael Barbaro and the New York Times reporter or subject matter expert. The show has amassed millions of listeners and has become one of the most popular news podcasts. Well, starting on Monday at 6:30, it's going to be a half-hour radio program on WLRN. Last week, I spoke with Michael about the process of putting the show together, some of his favorite episodes, and what listeners can expect. Michael, The Daily started a little more than 4 years ago as a podcast, right. As podcasts were starting to grow in popularity. And over the course of the pandemic, the audio format just surged. And now there's so much competition. But I'm wondering, for the New York Times, for The Daily, for you, what do you think's been the successful formula in maintaining that large audience with all that competition out there?
Well, you're absolutely right. We started 4 years ago, and we had this proposition in our head that maybe people would go into their iPhones and click play on a podcast that came out every day and was about the news. And I think what made people invested in that model day after day were a few things. The first is that we decided we were going to tell stories in the news a little bit differently than people had in the past. And we were going to tell them as stories with 25-minute conversations about the most important events and ideas of our time in ways that had a beginning and a middle and an end and were very richly produced with lots of sound and archival audio and a pacing that felt like you were really going someplace in the story rather than just a bunch of information coming at you really fast. It was going to unfurl. It's a kind of a slow, methodical way of telling stories that I think people appreciate because the news is complicated. And we came out at a really complicated moment. Donald Trump had just been elected. People were very thrown by the result. I think journalistically we all were. We didn't expect it. And a lot of events started to happen that were confusing and needed to be explained. And I think the show arrived at precisely the moment when technology, the iPhone and digital audio met a huge demand in a news audience for explanatory journalism that was moving and powerful.
You know, I think about when I was coming up in the business a long time ago, if you did radio, you were audio. If you did print, you were a writer. I mean, and you stuck to what you were doing. But today, you're doing pretty much everything. I think everybody has to know how to do everything. And of course, the New York Times still top tier when you talk about print and digital publications. Obviously, now they've gone off into documentaries and even virtual reality. But I'm wondering how much you and the team knew about audio storytelling. And was that a big transition when you're going from you were a reporter for a long time, going from being the writer and thinking in words, now you're thinking in audio?
It's a huge transition. It's a huge transition. I should say it was a very meaningful transition for me. I don't want to implicate my colleagues who came from public radio and really knew the industry. They came from WBUR. They came from WNYC, all over the country, and they understood audio, and they taught it to me. I was a print reporter, and my role was to kind of bring the newsroom along for this journey and recruit my colleagues to come on the show. But I had a huge gap in my understanding of what it meant to sit behind a microphone and try to tell a story, and they patiently taught it to me. I mean, and just to explain how little I understood, I remember the moment that a producer on the team said to me, "Michael, something funny just happened, and now you need to laugh, because if you don't laugh, the audience won't know that they have permission to laugh. Ha ha ha." So now I understand, okay, I have a role to play here. I am an advocate for the listener. I'm not just a print reporter. I'm a bridge between the story and the New York Times and the journalist I'm talking to, or the politician I'm talking to, or the person with COVID-19 I'm talking to, and the listener. And I have to be there and kind of bridge that relationship. And so it took me a while to do that. I think as a print reporter, you know how to do that in writing, but it's different in audio.
Talking about the difference in storytelling with audio, your July 15th episode on the political protests in Cuba, it really illustrates this point. So this is reporter Ernesto Londoño, who covers the southern cone of the Americas for the New York Times. Let's take a listen.
when I started getting text messages and clicking on videos on Sunday, my jaw dropped. What happened was protesters took to the streets in this little town that is not very well known, San Antonio de los Baños, which is near Havana, and started broadcasting live protests.
Mire, señores, todo un pueblo, señores, pidiendo libertad, venga.
And the more people that were taking to the streets, the more their neighbors wanted to sort of follow them. People started screaming, freedom, libertad, a clear reference to the authoritarian system that Cubans have been living in for decades.
Well, when I hear that clip, and I'm so glad you played it, of Ernesto, the word that comes to my mind is that it's really immersive, right? Ernesto is telling a story, and all around him is swelling the sounds from the ground that he is describing, and the two come together, and it's this incredibly powerful way of experiencing these protests in Havana. And the way we make an episode like that and a scene like that is that we plan like crazy. We have brainstorming sessions with our colleagues. Where does this story begin? It begins literally when I wake up one day and I hear about protests, right? That's what Ernesto said. And the audio producers, the brilliant producers on our team, they can literally hear that moment coming to life. And they start looking for the audio in the world. Maybe it's users posting things on social media. It's videos that have been produced, and we take those pieces of audio and assemble them around Ernesto's words after we have interviewed him. And so it's this kind of incredible alchemy of you know, storytelling through colleagues or through guests on the show and found audio in the world that we marry together. In many cases, our colleagues go out and collect the audio themselves. They use their iPhones or they use a microphone, and they record things, send it to us, and we do the work. And we've become kind of the audio arm of the New York Times, treating every story with the same meticulousness that our colleagues do in print or in video, but we do it in audio.
I'm thinking about what you said at the beginning, and you talk about the news, and the news is, it could be a lot of facts and information, and it's just, you know, it's thrown at the audience, whether it's the reader or the listener, just in bits and pieces. But mm-hmm. with the daily, you're taking a different approach. And so I'm wondering, when you're looking for a story, I mean, you've got episodes that, you know, the story isn't necessarily what's dominating the news cycle. But could you tell me a little bit more about that process and how you're deciding?
There are times where we want to be a news show because something big and important happened. And then there are times we feel that a story is so perfectly made for audio, and the way we tell a story, one story, 30 minutes, very heavily produced, kind of in the documentary style, that we don't mind that it's not in the news. I'll give you one of my favorite examples. Very early on in the history of the show, a colleague told us about a man she met who was going to be ending his own life in Canada under that country's law of assisted suicide. And she decided to record all of her interactions with him. Favorite season?
Spring.
Favorite bird?
Eagle.
When was the last time that you noticeably felt that you were free?
That I was free. When I knew that I could make the decision about ending my life.
And that included a living wake where his family and friends all came into a room and said goodbye to him. And you can hear this moment. It is some of the most powerful, memorable audio I've ever heard.
I brought a special memory for you. Do you remember this day?
Oh, do I ever? Oh, yes. God, do I look thin in that picture.
Oh, it was a great day.
Yes, it was. Everybody looks wonderful.
Aren't we happy? Look at us.
And when we put that episode together, we understood it was going to break the form of the show we were making. We were in the middle of the Trump era. There was news every day. There was urgency to what was happening around us. And this wasn't yesterday's news. It wasn't the weeks before. It wasn't the week before's news. It was just a story that was hugely compelling. And so we decided, let's tell it. Let's tell it even though it's not the newsiest story ever, because it's going to reveal a lot about policy and morality and humanity. And I remember we got a lot of feedback on that episode. people said, what is this? I don't think of the Daily as this. And some people liked it and some people didn't like it. And over time, I think our listeners have come to accept that we are this kind of big buffet of different kinds of stories being told. Sometimes yesterday's news in a very interesting way. Sometimes just a story we think you need to hear.
All right. You mentioned it before. You got to talk about the Trump administration because, you know, the Times, you know, one of those few news organizations really at the crosshairs of Donald Trump, repeatedly blamed for being liberal and biased. By the way, public media also gets that as well. I'm curious, though, what do you know about the listenership of The Daily? I'm always amazed at who's listening to public radio. You make assumptions, but then you find out, no, actually, we get a pretty good mix. But what have you learned about your listeners? Who are they and how do they reflect, you know, the citizenship of the United States?
What we know is that it is ideologically diverse in a way that would defy your expectations of classic audio listeners of perhaps the New York Times or any mainstream media company. And I think that's because we have sought out guests and forms of storytelling that are, I think, sometimes quite ideologically not just even neutral, but kind of confusing. And I like that. We did an episode with a gun store owner who had sold a weapon that was used in a mass shooting, Virginia Tech. And I remember the feedback we got was, I never thought I wanted to hear from the owner of a gun store, let alone a gun store owner who sold a gun used in a mass shooting. But he was so tortured by that fact and his relationship to guns and his pride in how to safely use guns was really apparent in the interview. And it was one of the more kind of morally complicated conversations I've ever had in my life. And I think those kinds of conversations where you're open-minded and you just hear people out is why The Daily does not fall in neatly into any of your ideological expectations.
As I mentioned before, you're a reporter, longtime reporter. You covered technology and business for The Washington Post. You joined The Times as a national correspondent covering the Trump campaign. But I wondered how all of that you incorporate into now your work as a host, the host of The Daily, and, you know, how those experiences help you. Because, again, it's a different set of skills in what you were doing before.
Yeah, I think what's nice about having a career in journalism that covers lots of different topics is that it has allowed me as the host of the show to be curious about a very wide range of subjects and not know too much. I'm not burdened by expert syndrome. I don't pretend to be the authority on the business world, although I covered Walmart for 5 years, and I have thought a lot about what it means to operate in the world of business, and I've covered politics, many presidential campaigns, both Democratic and Republican. And that's really useful to host a show like The Daily, to have that background where I can think back to, well, that reminds me of the Mitt Romney presidential campaign in 2012, but it's different than the Donald Trump campaign in 2016 and the Joe Biden presidential campaign of 2020. So it's useful to have that background, but I'm grateful to have not become such an expert in any one thing that that I'm going to drone on and on about it as the host.
I want to point out this one particular story. This is, I think, is the perfect example. When you talk about, for example, emotions coming into a conversation, this was an episode with New York Times reporter Patty Mazzei talking about the Surfside condo tragedy back in June. Let's take a listen.
The focus, according to all of the authorities, has to remain, for now, in finding the missing. Mm-hmm. And while they do that, they're going to put everything sort of on a secondary plane. And every day they're going to go in every 4 hours to the Grand Beach Hotel near the site, inside a ballroom, to try to give information to these families who are sort of gathered in silence as an official stands behind a microphone with an easel in the back and tries to tell them what progress has been made. And it's never a lot.
I can't tell you the number of times where guests on the show have drawn out tremendous emotion in me as a host. And there have been a couple of moments, two I can remember, where I really felt like I was audibly emotional about a conversation. And I think there have been times we decided to let that play. You know, journalists are human beings. And I think the more honest we are about that, the better. You know, I think there's long been a tradition in journalism of the kind of stentorian anchor behind the desk telling you a story. But I think there's a reason why we all remember the moment Walter Cronkite, you know, lifted his glasses and wiped his eye when John F. Kennedy was killed. And it's because he's a human being. And I think that journalists can be human beings.
All right, to lighten the mood a little bit as we finish up here, you know, look, a lot of people obviously listen to the podcast. There's still a lot of people who don't listen to podcasts, but the good news is The Daily's coming to WLRN. Weeknights at 6:30. So for anybody who's not listened to The Daily, this is your chance. You're talking to them. Tell them, what can the listener expect?
I think listeners of WLRN can expect a very fresh and very powerful new way of hearing the news that is going to sound truly different from what you're used to hearing, but is going to retain something really essential to what this radio station and what the New York Times stand for, which is integrity, which is the truth, which is a real commitment to understanding why things are happening and explaining them as best we can. There's so many stories that deserve this kind of a treatment, this kind of a rich, highly produced, really thoughtful way of understanding the world. And that's what I hope we deliver every day.
Again, that's Michael Barbaro, the host of The Daily Podcast. The podcast is a half-hour program that's going to play at 6:30 weekdays here on WLRN starting Monday, August 2nd. All right, let's end the show by taking you on a journey. We're going to go to Key West because every year, hundreds, if not thousands, of Hemingway fans make their way to the nation's southernmost point for this festival. It's called Hemingway Days, and they have an annual Hemingway look-alike competition. It's at the iconic Sloppy Joe's Bar. Men from across the U.S. don those white beards, and they do their best impressions of old Papa. So I decided I got to go to Key West as a reporter and a contestant. Now, I don't look like Ernest Hemingway, like, at all. I don't have the big belly or the big, beautiful white beard. No, I went as a younger Hemingway. And I gotta tell you, I was really nervous, and I had no idea what I was in for. So here's the thing. The event was held over 3 nights. There were more than 130 contestants. That's more than 100 guys who look like, some more than others, old Papa. Only 4 contestants showed up as a young Hemingway. I was one of them. So on Friday night, I stepped up on the stage and I made my pitch for why they should pick me.
You know, I thought I was the youngest Papa. I don't know, but I will say this. It's just an honor to have the opportunity to be up here. So many good-looking papas. You got beautiful beards, beautiful bellies. Give me 30 years, I'll catch up to you.
I know. Maybe not the best pitch.
You know, there was just a handful of contestants back in 1981 when the contest started, and it was actually a few members of the Hemingway family judged the contest. Now the contest is judged by the former winners. Once you win, you become a judge. But it's really gone international, too. We've had contestants from all over the world in this contest.
That's Donna Edwards, by the way. She's the marketing manager for Sloppy Joe's Bar. Now, she told me that the winners over the years eventually formed a nonprofit to run the event, and they've raised a lot of money for scholarships, over $2 million over the years. Now, sadly, I didn't make it into the final round on Saturday. Now, Saturday afternoon, I joined the Papas, probably still hungover from the night before, at the bar because it was time for the running of the bulls. And no, it's not like the running of the bulls. There were no real bulls running on Duval Street. This is just a few wooden bulls on wheels that carried some of the former winners around the block. And, you know, the guys were just smoking and drinking and singing. And now I was able to grab a couple of the former winners.
Papa Wally Collins from Phoenix, Arizona, and I won in 2014.
Papa Richard Phillip from Fayetteville, Texas, and it's 2017.
So I asked them,
Tell me the truth. What does it take to win this competition?
Well, everybody up there has been told for years that they look like Hemingway. So they come here, and remember, this is a look-alike contest. And most of the guys have a good look for Hemingway. But first of all, we want to know you're a good guy and a guy we're going to be hanging out with for the next 15 or 20 years. So it's a combination. It's a fraternity look-alike contest. And some guys get upset, well, I look just like Hemingway. Yeah, but, you know, maybe we don't like you.
That night I came back to the bar for the final round. And it was really intense. And then it came down to a three-way tie. So they had a runoff, and they did eventually pick the winner.
Hemingway look-alike contest is Zach Taylor!
So Zach Taylor ends up winning. Congratulations to him, by the way. It's a fraternity. Not sure if I'm going to be able to get in, but it was a lot of fun. Check out some of the photos, by the way, from this year's Hemingway Days by heading to our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, July 29th. Sundial Senior Producers Chris Remington, Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editors, Katie Lepre. Our news directors, Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives pushing all the buttons today. And the music is from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo. Find them at gopalo.com. All right, we have some exciting news. The Sundial Book Club coming back next month for the month of August. To write this down, we're going to be reading The Cubans, Ordinary Lives in Extraordinary Times by Anthony De Palma. Just go to our Facebook page, Sundial Book Club, ask to join, learn more. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.